Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. An ambitious hour here on the program. Let's show a little hemispheric solidarity with the people and especially the soccer fans of Brazil today. We're all Americans today. More about that later. Also later, another woman in our series, Under Her Skin, living with breast cancer, a disease with a surprising survival divide that crosses the color line, leaving African-American women far more vulnerable than their white peers. Plus, poet and scholar Nikki Giovanni looks back at the importance of poet and musician Langston Hughes as we bring you a 1957 recording of Hughes unearthed from the WNYC archives. WNYC turns 90 years old this week. But we begin with a crisis that increasingly the whole world is watching. The thousands of child migrants streaming across the U.S. border from Central America have placed a new sense of urgency in the headlines. The Catholic Church is one of the institutions on the front lines of this humanitarian crisis. Roman Catholic Bishop Mark Seitz of El Paso, Texas, after serving immigrant communities for decades as a priest, his diocese in El Paso has now been thrust into the middle of all this as it cares for many of the undocumented youths who have fled violence and poverty in their home countries. Bishop Seitz has also brought the complexity of the issue to the attention of lawmakers. He has testified twice before Congress in the past 2 weeks about his work in immigrant communities.
Our interest begins with serving the people who are in need. That's what the church does. We're concerned about those who are poor, those who are in danger of their life, and we serve without really asking all of the details about whether they have the proper papers or whether they are within our border or outside of our border. We have a concern for everyone. So that's where our involvement begins.
Bishop, I wonder if you could speak to motive. I mean, the president has said, please don't make this journey from Guatemala or Honduras or Nicaragua to the United States. Would you ever advise a young person to take a journey like this?
I've personally advised people in Honduras not to make that journey, and the church has been giving that message there for many years. I remember when I was working there in 2002, that was a very strong message that the church was giving, that it's better not attempt that perilous journey, and trying to remind them that when they arrived in the United States, there would be new trials all of their own. Still, you know, the best analogy I can give is if you find yourself in a burning building, at a certain point, it doesn't matter how many people say, don't jump. When the flames are licking at your back, you're going to jump. And I think a lot of these people feel like leaving for any place, including the United States, is their only option. And the migrants that I've spoken to, including the children, who really, I would like to point out, are a very special case, they've been told and they've heard. Again, they just don't feel as though they have another choice. And from the standpoint of the church, we believe that one of the best solutions, if you will, to this problem is to begin to address the root causes of the issue, to be involved in whatever ways we can in those home countries. We are attempting to do that as a church. We should attempt to do that as a nation if we really want to stem the tide. As one of my colleagues often says, until there is human security, there will not be national security. So unless we deal with this, there's no number of fences we can set up that will keep people from seeking our borders.
Forgetting fences for a moment, does the White House have its head in the sand, do you think, by not recognizing this as a full-fledged refugee crisis?
Well, I'm sure they're under a lot of pressures. And in a certain sense, in our nation, we haven't really experienced these kinds of situations at our borders. We've been a world leader when it comes to refugee situations in other nations, and we've helped frame the international law that guides the treatment of refugees. So when people are crossing a war-torn area from Syria to Lebanon, to Jordan, from the state of Somalia into Kenya, and the like, we have been one of the leaders in saying, yes, these people need to be accepted and not turned away.
So is this a crisis in part the creation of American politics in some way?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert in American politics, but certainly these people are our neighbors. Many might raise the question about whether we have some responsibility as a nation based upon the fact that we are bankrolling these narco traffickers who are ruling the day in these countries by our drug use. We might also ask whether other economic accords which have benefited our country a great deal have really benefited the small farmers and the like in these countries, or whether they've put them out of business, thus leading to even greater economic hardship.
So your message to all Americans would be, whether you're in the White House, whether you're in a position of authority or in Congress or just a citizen, look into your heart and soul and to see where your own responsibility might reside for these individuals who are claiming refuge here in the United States for whatever reason.
Absolutely. That's, I believe, what Christians always do, and all people of goodwill. You know, this world is getting smaller and smaller. And I think one of the things we're witnessing here is that what we used to consider a world away is now very much at our doorstep. And particularly when we're talking about neighbors in our own hemisphere, we have to be concerned. We don't have the luxury of being unconcerned about what is happening in their home countries.
Bishop Mark Seitz is the bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of El Paso, Texas. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Bishop.
You're very welcome. God bless.
We continue now with our series, Under Her Skin, Living with Breast Cancer. It's one of those myths about cancer, and breast cancer in particular, that it is a trauma for middle-aged or older women. The woman we are going to meet this hour is still in her 20s. She's also a member of a group far more vulnerable to not surviving cancer. She's African-American, and African-American women are on average 40% more likely to die of breast cancer than their white counterparts. On Monday, we heard from Lisa Eccles in Memphis, Tennessee. The wife and mother of two just underwent a double mastectomy in order to rid her body of the cancer that had moved in. If you missed her story, you can find it at thetakeaway.org/series/breastcancer. Crystal Miller was just 27 years old when she felt a lump in her breast that turned out to be cancerous. But she brought her bright outlook into our studios when she visited us. In fact, it was the first thing she says people notice about her when they meet her these days.
I would think my smile, happy, you know, you would see happiness. A woman on a mission, tend to have my head up high and maybe fast pace and some heels, you know, someone who's like has somewhere to go and is going to accomplish something.
Crystal is a nurse at Mount Sinai Medical Center here in New York. She does data management and research on cancer for a living, and she knows exactly what's going on inside her body.
I'm stage one. I'm actually triple positive. Some people are triple negative. I'm triple positive. 1 centimeter. I've had a lumpectomy. And also an additional thing is I've had my chemo before surgery. A lot of people have it after surgery. In my given case, it was better for me to have it before surgery. Something I struggled with, mind you, in the beginning.
A year since her diagnosis, Crystal has gone in for her first radiation treatment. But between her job, where she works with cancer patients all day, and her now own struggle with cancer, Crystal says she doesn't want the C word to define her.
This is an aspect of my life. It doesn't overshadow what's going on currently in other parts of my life. It doesn't overshadow anything that I accomplished already or that I'm going to accomplish. And, you know, that's important to me. I like it that way. It hasn't taken over everything.
When you first were diagnosed, what were your thoughts?
You know, I was shocked because, you know, I don't have this in my family. I work in cancer and my patients tend to be older. And, you know, I just didn't see this coming. Obviously, you know, when I felt the lump, I had a gut feeling, but I was just shocked and I didn't know how it was going to affect my life or my future. And, you know, it was scary.
And part of that is because you're so young.
Right. And, you know, I didn't know what stage I was. And, you know, I haven't done a lot of things that I want to do. You know, I haven't been married. I haven't had a child. And it was scary.
being in a medical environment, how do you avoid going down the rabbit hole of, oh, there's this treatment, there's this treatment, there's this research, there's this is a journal article to read, there's this new thing, there's this new... How do you keep from doing that?
I think in the beginning, I tried to look up stuff, and when something, the doctor said something, I'd run home and like Google it. What's tamoxifen? What's this? And I think it can kind of hurt you a little bit. I am all for people supporting each other and learning about different, you know, experiences. And but everything that happens to somebody else doesn't mean it's going to happen to you. So for now, I tend, and I say now because maybe in the future as I continue to get treated, maybe I'll feel differently. But for now, I'm not really looking at things online. I have a rapport with my medical team, my breast oncologist and my breast surgeon. And, you know, I trust that they will bring the information as it comes up and that they will, if I need some type of data or supportive information, that they will be able to provide it. You know, I become obsessed when I'm looking online and Googling, and I don't want to get the wrong information and not have somebody there who's, you know, this is their area, and not be able to interpret it with me and, you know, explain it to me.
Well, it sounds also like you've made a real conscious decision. There's data, mm-hmm. and then there's Crystal's life.
Right.
You know, and,
right.
and Crystal's life is real and data is kind of sitting there on the page.
Right, right.
How'd you come to that?
I think any significant event, especially breast cancer, it makes you learn about yourself. And now I know for sure that I'm controlling. This is something that I'm not in control of. So now what? You know, how do you proceed? I just think I've learned so much about myself. Something's good, something's bad, and I'm trying to correct it. And I try to do the best for what works for me. And that might not work for the next person, but I do what works best for me and what keeps me positive and on the right track.
Does it concern you, the vulnerability of African-American women in breast cancer and the statistics and really the lack of data that exists sometimes for that population?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. You know, you see it a lot with, you know, especially young Black women, and it's scary to me, and I don't know what's being done. I don't know what the future means, but I just feel like there's a lot of African-American women have breast cancer. It's like, and you can't talk to somebody and them not say that they don't know somebody or maybe it happened to them that has breast cancer. And I don't know what that means. You know, I don't know what that means for me, and I don't know what that means for maybe my future children. I don't know. And it is, I do feel very vulnerable in this given situation.
What's the darkest question you ask your doctor?
I mean, definitely about survival, you know, like, what's my prognosis? What is the chances of beating this? What is my cure rate? Is there a cure rate? Those are the questions that in the beginning, I was not scared to ask them. I wanted mm-hmm. to know. That's the type of person I am. I really want it to be laid out on the table. I like percentages. I don't think this works for everybody. You need to know yourself, like you were saying in the beginning. This is a very personal thing. You know, you need to personalize it. What works for your friend or somebody that you meet on the street or, you know, in a support group might not work for you. And you need to be careful of that. But, you know, those are the questions that I wanted answers to.
So here's the hard stuff.
Uh-huh. I'm ready.
you're 28, right?
Yeah. I was 27 when diagnosed.
Right. 2 days before Christmas. Merry
yeah.
Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
You know, dating in your late 20s often is not fun. You know?
Right.
But it must be particularly challenging for you. I mean, just what's the...
How does that go?
How does that work?
I don't know. I have to figure it out. I haven't really dated. I just... You know, it's interesting. In the beginning, it feels like it's going to be a burden on somebody. I'm like, who's going to want to deal with this? You know, and because I think people hear about it, but I don't think they understand what it totally means.
Right.
You know, the nitty gritty and what it means with certain things. You know, fertility
wise. You know,
yeah.
People go, you're so brave. And then you go, oh, please change this.
Yeah. In the beginning, that bothered me so much. You would have thought I was dying the next day or like they were going to plan my funeral. But I think when it comes to that, I'm just going to have to learn, like trial and error, you know, when's the best time to bring it up? This is something I'm going through. You know, I have to take tamoxifen, which it's going to be for 5 years, 5 to 10 years. There are potential side effects of that. And, having to like explain that to them, it's a little scary. You know, I don't know how they're going to react. Or am I going to be rejected? I don't know. You know, I don't
know. Let me just say, anybody who rejects you for tamoxifen is a loser, okay?
Yeah, I mean, and even like my fertility, you know, I wasn't with somebody when I had to make fertility decisions in the beginning. And it happened so quickly because you have to make it before treatment. And, you know, I opted not to do fertility treatment. I wanted to get started right away. If it has affected my fertility, you know, making sure that the person that I'm going to marry or be with, like, understands that, you know what I mean? That, you know, there's a potential that you might not be able to have, I might not be able to child the ideal way or the conventional, you know, the conventional way. So something I think about, in the beginning, it bothered me. You know, that was one of the most upsetting things, I think. You know, I've heard things from people when I went to support groups and they're like in tears when they're talking about things, you know, when even when it's like their husband and stuff like that. And I'm like, that's your husband. What about me, who's like a new person?
Well, all I can say is, you know, a lot of that stuff changes.
I mean, yeah.
When I got out of the hospital with a spinal cord injury, the doctor said, you'll never have kids.
Right, right.
I have five.
Right, right. So, yeah, so I try to focus on the positive, and I, like I said, only speaking positive things, things that I want to see happen. So, yeah, hopefully, you know, I mean, I didn't, you know, actually before all of this, I was one of those people, like the typical single New Yorker. I was like, maybe at 35, 36, maybe I'll think about it. I didn't even know if I wanted kids, to be honest. I didn't think that, like, was going to complete me. I wanted to be married, though. You know, I wanted to be married, and I was like, that would be my family. If a kid happens, it happens. And it's funny, because when this happened, it changed. I'm like, wait, I want a kid. Like, I don't want this decision being made for me. You know, I want to make the decision. And but I started to stay positive, and I think it will happen if I want it to happen.
Crystal, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Crystal Miller is a nurse at Mount Sinai Medical Center, diagnosed with breast cancer in December of 2013. To hear an extended version of our conversation and to listen to her audio diary, visit us at thetakeaway.org/series/breast cancer. And we want to invite everyone to take part in this exploration of breast cancer, especially for vulnerable African-American women. Tell us what it's like to live with the disease. We've started a Facebook group. We'd love for you to join. Go to facebook.com, type in Under Her Skin to find us. There you can share your stories, post pictures, and take part in our ongoing conversation about the trials and triumphs of living with breast cancer. Again, you can join our group by typing in the phrase Under Her Skin on Facebook. We'll have lots more there.
Goes a long way and a goal! Holmes here, it's closer! He's driven, and that's three! Scores 4-0! He's there again! 5-0! 6-0! It's again, that's seven! Germany in seventh heaven.
But all hemispheres aside, you have to hand it to Germany. Let's go to our good friend John Schaefer, who's the host of Soundcheck, a soccer maniac who also predicted that Germany would be in this position. He's also the host of New Sounds at our partner station, WNYC. At the risk of assaulting taste, I suspect Germans in Rio today are about as popular as the boys from Brazil at 1978 movie.
I'm not so sure how long that's going to last, though. If Argentina wins today...
Oh.
And the final pits Germany against Argentina. Yeah. You may see all those Brazilians back in the arena.
Guy was saying that,
waving German little German flags.
So what happened? That was a clinic yesterday. What the heck was going on?
You know, it looked as if the Germans had rolled in something disgusting before taking the pitch, and the Brazilians didn't want to get near them. I mean, it was just you had German players.
That's an interesting strategy.
You had German players in the penalty area, where of all places on the field you think they'd be closed down, and there was nobody, no Brazilians nearby. Yes, they put on a clinic, but it's easy to put on a clinic when there are none of those pesky defenders around to get in the way.
Do they have enough psychiatrists for the goaltender in Brazil?
For Julio Cesar?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I felt bad for him. He was left all alone in the back there. I mean, the fourth, fifth goals, you know, he was clearly trying to do what he could, but he was doing it all by himself.
Now, is there anything you saw on the pitch that suggests, you know, that this play would be better against Argentina or the Netherlands?
Well, clearly Germany's not going to put seven past either Argentina or the Netherlands. I mean, this was a complete meltdown. I think what you saw was a team that came out I'm talking about Brazil now, a team that came out flying on emotion and adrenaline.
And a lot of pressure. I mean, if you're hosting, it's too much pressure. I mean, on some
well, but
level.
Also you're missing your talisman. You know,
yeah,
Neymar is
true.
Out.
That's true.
Although, as I had written in my blog, I was more concerned for Brazil about the lack of Thiago Silva, who I think by far is their best defender. I thought that was going to hurt them more. But even with Silva back
just
there.
Mr. Know-it-all. Just write about Germany, write about the Silva. Just like Mr. Nen-nen-nen-nen today, aren't you? And you also were right about this. We wouldn't be hearing much of this song as a result of the contest yesterday. You predicted on our show that if we heard a lot of this, it would be a bad sign for Germany.
Right.
Yeah, this is not a popular tune.
We're not
explain the background of this tune again.
The song is translated, the title translates, "The World Cup is Ours," and it was created by the Brazilians after their first World Cup victory in 1958. They sang it again in 1962, and sure enough, they won the World Cup again. And as I told you last time, if you heard a lot of this song in Rio and São Paulo and Brasilia these days, it would have been bad news for everybody else. You ain't hearing that song anywhere now.
Well, maybe it'll be great for the 40th anniversary of that song if they win in Russia in 2018.
They're still going to be... this is a country that is still smarting from a 1950 defeat when most of the country hadn't even been born yet.
Which makes you a little bit scared about the Argentina, if there's an Argentina-Brazil match.
The fourth place. Yeah. It's hard to get the adrenaline pumping for a third place match, but if it is Brazil Argentina, that's Boston, that's Red Sox Yankees, you know, that's Flyers Rangers. It's just a really passionate rivalry.
Well, to get you back on your mainstream expertise here in the battle between, you know, Beethoven and Villa Lobos, okay, in music, what does it mean to have an all Europe final versus, Argentina-Brazil in the third
quarter?
Well,
the main thing it would mean is that a European team will, for the first time, win a World Cup when it's held outside of Europe, you know, in South America. That would be huge. Argentina went in as kind of the bookies' favorite.
Yeah.
There's billions of dollars being bet worldwide on this.
Yeah.
I think they're probably still the favorite, although a lot of people will be looking differently at Germany in the wake of last night's demolition.
Still got your money on Deutschland?
I'm still hopeful.
All right, John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds on our partner station, WNYC. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
We may have you back.
I hope so.
We're going to take you down to the river now for a few moments. Poet Langston Hughes wrote of rivers and history and time. You reach in and something like a gold nugget surprisingly stares up at you from your own hand. Langston Hughes wrote the lyrics to this Muddy Waters tune, Goodbye Newport Blues, after a historic race riot back in 1960.
Everything is sad, sad, sad.
For nearly half of the 20th century, poet Langston Hughes' words were part of the river of American culture.
Yes, what a gloomy day, Newport.
Its voice, its pain, its struggle to make good on its undelivered promises of freedom, its delusions of grandeur amidst unparalleled prosperity. Here he is reading from one of his earliest poems.
I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans. And I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
Negro writers, just by being black, have always been on the black list. Do you know that there are libraries in our country that will not stock a book by a Negro writer?
This nugget of history was plumbed from the river of WNYC's historical archives as we look back 90 years since this radio station became a part of the Voice of New York City. It's a panel discussion organized by what is now called the National Association of Authors back in 1957. This speech aired on WNYC Radio in June of that year. WNYC turned 90 this week, 90 years of speaking truth to power, 90 years of giving voice to the voiceless.
There are towns in our country where Negro newspapers, Negro magazines for which I write, other Negro writers write, cannot be sold, or if they're sold at all, they have to be bootlegged, sold under the counter, and the sheriff better not catch the person selling them. There are American magazines, even in this day and time, that have never published anything by a Negro writer. There are film studios that never hire a Negro writer, never have hired one. And so censorship for us begins with the color line.
Them that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news.
Langston Hughes, for his all-too-short life, was a voice of progressive politics, of jazz — this famous Billie Holiday recording was his favorite — a voice of literature and the 20th century struggle to be an American. Poet and professor Nikki Giovanni has been teaching the works of Langston Hughes to her students at Virginia Tech for more than two decades.
The phenomenon of the enslaved finding the voice of hope in the American situation is something that has simply not right now been explored nearly enough. So when you say authentic American voice, there can be nothing more authentic than the enslaved being brought to this country, being mistreated, being misunderstood, and being totally unloved, and yet finding a way to be proud of being an American. I think Langston did that incredibly well. And I think that the American voice, whatever else is wrong with America, America has stood for hope. And as long as America stands for hope, there will be people who will love her. It's when we finally allow the greedy and the crazy to push hope away that America will lose whatever purpose it has in being.
Well, son, I'll tell you. Life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had tacks in it and splinters and boards torn up and places with no carpet on the floor. Bare. But all the time, I's been a-climbing on and reaching landings and turning corners and sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So, boy, don't you turn back. Don't you sit down on the steps 'cause you finds it kind of hard. Don't you fall now, for I's still going, honey. I's still climbing. And life for me ain't been no crystal stair.
We have in America today about a dozen top-flight, frequently published, and I think really good Negro writers. Do you not think it strange that of that dozen, more than half of them live abroad? I don't mean they've just gone on a visit. They're living abroad, far away from their own people, away from their problems, away from their audience, their publishers, away from the sources of their material. And why are they living somewhere outside of this, our own country? They're living outside of our country because of stones that were thrown at Authorine Lucy on the campus of the University of Alabama are really stones thrown at all of us who don't happen to be white. Because the shadow of Montgomery and the bombs under Reverend King's house shadowed them and shatter them too. Because the body of little Emmett Till drowned in the Mississippi River and no one brought to justice haunts them too. Because the Jim Crow schools from New York to New Orleans, Jim Crow them too.
Langston uses the term home. And I think that the phenomenon of being a black American is that where is your home? We, my generation, would clearly be the children of Langston Hughes. He left America, he traveled, but he lived in Harlem. And I think it's important. My generation wasn't thinking about moving out of the United States. We thought it's time to change the United States. One of the reasons that I think we are a wonderful generation is that we decided to fight the battle here. We decided that it's enough.
Langston Hughes' poetry, his family's place in history, going back to the abolitionist movement in America, was part of the decision to finally say enough and embrace the land that seemed never to want African Americans to find that home.
It is glorious, this history of ours. It is a great story, that of the Negro in America. It begins way before America was America, or the USA, the USA. It covers a wide span, our story. Let me tell it to you.
My great-grandmother, who was named Cornelia Watson, and we called her Mama Dear. Mama Dear would say, "Nimine," and that was one word, "Nimine," no matter what was going on, "Nimine." And Mr. Hughes's grandfather was with John Brown at Harper's Ferry, and that he had that shirt that his grandfather, the blood of his grandfather. So Mr. Hughes had a depth and a connection. But he also knew that at some point you have to say, "Nimine," and you move on into Harlem and you try to have this conversation with the future, which I think he did incredibly well.
What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode?
A selection from Langston Hughes' gospel tune, "Devil, Take Yourself Away." Thanks to Professor Nikki Giovanni at Virginia Tech and to the WNYC Audio Archives. Happy 90th birthday, WNYC. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.